Hey, everybody, this is Stu Smith with another Tactical Fitness Report, and we have a special guest today, Rebecca Ivory. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, let me just give you a quick little introduction, if I can. You have just completed a Doctor of Nursing practice, right, where you're focusing on psychiatric nurse practitioner, that's what you're going to be doing, you know, with your licenses. Your doctoral research was focused on treating trauma symptoms and chronic pain. And through that research, you crossed into a special operations group of people, Navy SEALs specifically. And that's where our paths kind of cross, because I have written about and interviewed some folks about operator syndrome. And it seems to me like you were following a similar parallel path, you know, through your, you know, academic studies, and are now getting into more of the, you know, actual hands-on of all of that. So if you would just explain a little bit about your journey of going in through this, and, you know, how that came about to the term operator syndrome. And, you know, finally, the question, you know, is like, how do you define operator syndrome? So
thank you so much for having me. Real quick, your name came up among, I've talked to about 100 Navy SEALs over the last couple of years, and your name comes up actually very frequently from a lot of them. So it's a huge honor to be able to talk to you today. So
thank you.
I just completed my doctorate in nursing practice, which is a practice doctorate. It's applied research. So my entire goal as a nurse at this point is finding solutions based on evidence that we have research. So I apply the research to practice to find better ways to treat things and to care for patients and things like that. So when I decided to go back for my doctorate, my husband transferred his post 9/11 GI bill to me. And I decided that he's active duty, he's a fighter pilot, and I decided, since I was using his post 9/11 GI Bill, wow, like, wouldn't this be a great opportunity for me to work with the Navy or the military in general? And I knew I wanted to focus in psych. I had been a psych nurse and worked in psych nursing for over a decade at that point. And so I started using my resources, as we military spouses do.
Sure.
And I started looking for people to talk to who knew about military psych, because I had to, as I was applying, present options for things I wanted to work on as a doctoral student. And after a series of networking, I come up with a few topics that I thought were really interesting. I'm not able to work ethically in tactical aviation because my husband's a fighter pilot. So I had to work in another area of the Navy. And eventually I was networked to somebody whose name and position I'm not going to share, but anyone who is active duty or a veteran will probably really enjoy this story. This guy's boss told him, we have this random spouse, you know, basically free labor. You need to talk to her. He's in charge of, or was at the time in charge of, a lot of health care for the military generally. And he said, I have this time slot. You have 3 minutes. You better call me at the start of this 3 minutes. I don't have a lot of time for this. He was voluntold that he had to talk to me. I saw the email and I was like, oh God, this guy is not going to want to talk to me. And so I get on the phone and he said, you're the fighter pilot wife who's going to work with Navy SEALs. And I said to him, I was like, no, that's not what. And he said, your email says you want to help the Navy and you work in psych, and the Navy SEALs won't talk to us. And I bet they'll talk to you. And if you want to help the Navy and you want to do something in psych, you have to talk to Navy SEALs. And he basically hung up on me. And
okay.
And yeah. And I, you know, I'm like trying to get in a word in edgewise for my other topics. And he's like, nope, Navy SEALs. This is it. This is, if you want my opinion and I know better than you do what the military needs, this is what we need. So I basically used all of my resources and all of my knowledge as a Navy spouse and said, okay, so I don't know very much about the SEAL community and I don't know what they need and I don't know how to help. But I do know that one thing that really bothers a lot of people, active duty and veterans in the military community, is that nobody ever asks us or them what they want. It's like people just show up in communities and say, I know better than you and you need to do X, Y, and Z. And I hear that all the time from my husband's community. You know, people show up and say, well, I know better than you, and this is what you need to do. And oftentimes they already know what needs to be done, but nobody's doing it. And they feel like no one will listen to them. Mm-hmm. So I decided that I would contact Navy SEALs through social media and try to talk to people. And that's what happened.
Okay.
And so I actually came to chronic pain and trauma symptoms because I was told this by the community.
Okay. And what did you find your research led you to open other doors and to find new routes to continue moving forward? And where did that hit when you discovered the term operator syndrome?
So I talked with about 70 guys on background, current Navy SEALs, former Navy SEALs, all about the same age range, like 30s, 40s, maybe early 50s, because they were self-referring themselves to me. Mm-hmm. And so they were kind of talking to me about what was going on in the community as just a total outsider, and sharing stories with me and different things. And what ended up coming up most frequently were things like chronic pain and trauma were the two things that came up the most frequently. I was tracking, you know, the topics. But other things that came up were things like sleep, relationship issues, things like that. All of these things that fit into operator syndrome. But the word, the term operator syndrome wasn't out there yet. So, and this was in maybe 2017, 2018, 2019, when I was really talking to a lot of SEALs at the time. And so I was sort of seeing this operator syndrome framework, but without a name for it. And, but the SEALs were themselves were telling me about it. And it wasn't until I had actually developed my research that I was going to be doing that in the end of 2020, I found your article on military.com.
Okay.
And I said, oh, this is really interesting. Allostatic load. Oh, so there's this person who's calling this called operator syndrome. So I went to all of the links that you shared in that article, and like my mind was blown. Finally, I had a framework for describing what I was seeing in real time and what the SEALs themselves were describing to me.
Oh, that's awesome. So how do you define operator syndrome, if you don't mind me asking? Because, I mean, it is pretty, I've heard several different, because it's multifaceted.
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm just curious how you see it and where does your research tend to focus on when you look at this multifaceted syndrome?
So I come to everything from a nursing perspective and a psychiatric perspective. So you have a couple different things colliding. So any syndrome, and you can probably think of a couple different kinds of syndromes, like, you know, there's operator syndrome. There's also something like Down syndrome. All a syndrome is a collection of symptoms that when you look at each individual symptom that someone is experiencing, you may or may not realize that it's related to something else. And this concentration of symptoms are occurring in a concentration of a population and occurring very frequently. So from a nursing perspective, I'm looking at this like, you have this constellation of symptoms, which is a great way to describe it, like Dr. Free describes it. Yeah. And as a nurse, I am looking at all of these issues, and I'm understanding that because all of these different things are occurring in a very similar population, there must be a similar cause. And as a doctor of nursing practice, I need to learn what that cause is. And because I'm applied research, I'm looking for how can we use the research on it to create solutions to fix the problem, mitigate the problem, lessen the effect of the problem. So from my perspective as a nurse, what I am seeing is sort of the what everyone else is seeing. I'm looking at the issues with sleeplessness. I'm looking at sort of in the list of symptoms of that we see among operators, the sleep disruption, sexual dysfunction, relationship dysfunction. I understand that the endocrine issues that are caused by operator syndrome are sort of driving operator syndrome, right? But
sure.
The things that people are talking to me about are things like, I literally don't feel like I used to. I can't describe it. And I don't know what's wrong with me. I can't remember things anymore. I don't remember my kids' birthdays. I don't remember my anniversary with my wife. My wife is mad at me all the time because, you know, I'm constantly stressed out. I can't turn off. I am hyper fixated on all of these things. And I used to not be like that. I want to go to sleep. I get into bed. I at the same time every night and I can't fall asleep for 3 hours or I wake up early every day. I'm not intimate with my wife anymore. I'm getting into arguments with guys on my team, rage out of nowhere. So as a nurse, that's what I hear from these guys. And then, you know, when I look at the bigger picture, obviously also I'm looking at the research for the drivers, but that's really what I'm seeing. And so operator syndrome is sort of this, it is an overwhelming change in one's life after years of operating.
Okay.
And it's very hard for the guys to describe. And a lot of times they don't know what caused it. It's insidious, but it is a drastic change in their life that has occurred a couple years after becoming a Navy SEAL.
Okay. So tell me this, what is the difference between this and PTSD?
So that is a great question. So let me talk about my research for a second, because
sure.
My research will illustrate this point. So what I did as a doctoral student is with the community, in conjunction with talking with Navy SEALs, I developed a treatment plan that would treat both their chronic pain and trauma symptoms at the same time. And in talking with them, I learned what they wanted. And then I went back to research and figured out, okay, this is what they want. Is there any evidence in the research? Yes, there is, for what they want. Okay, like how can we make all these things work, right? So part of my research was actually giving a diagnostic test for PTSD to Navy SEALs and former SEALs and former frogmen, UDT guys. And what I found on a lot of the PTSD tests that I did is that technically these guys scored high enough to be diagnosed with PTSD, but they were missing very specific criteria in the diagnostic process. So when you have somebody who has PTSD, they have, you know, they check all these boxes. Almost none of the guys that I tested checked a very specific box, which was avoidance of triggers, of things that might cause them trauma. And so what we're actually seeing among SEALs and former SEALs is that they're having symptoms of trauma, nightmares. They get spun up very easily. They have like this high stress response, but they're not doing other things like avoiding triggers. Like they're not avoiding watching the news. They're not avoiding talking about things that have happened in the past, things like that. So it's like with operator syndrome, you see symptoms of PTSD, but not always actual PTSD. It's
yeah.
Like they don't actually fit the criteria for having PTSD.
Yeah, I think that was one of the issues that rang true to Dr. Free's work as well.
Yeah.
And he really tended to focus more hormonally as a treatment for it first, to kind of clean up some of the low testosterone, high cortisol, you know, and see how that helped with sleep. right? And started, so he handled it, it seems like, more on a physiological level. How do you handle it on a different level, like on a psychiatric level?
That's a really interesting question, because in psychiatry, yes, we absolutely will test patients. We should be testing patients. Best practice is to do, blood work maybe before we diagnose people, or at the same time that we're diagnosing people. Someone might come in for their first appointment and you'll be looking at the criteria. They're saying, oh, I have all these symptoms. You're like, yeah, you kind of, yep, sounds like you. But also we should be doing blood tests and different things. Not everyone does that. And what I'm seeing in the research from Dr. Free and from other research has come out since 2020, showing more data that yes, Navy SEALs and other operators, after some time operating, have changes in their brain that cause endocrine dysfunction. And that might be driving a lot of their psychiatric stuff as right. well as their other symptoms. So I would have never diagnosed any of these guys that I was working with PTSD, because they didn't actually meet the criteria. When you actually looked at the list of criteria, they didn't meet it.
Sure.
And what should be happening is when you see something like that with operators, you need to do blood work to find out if they're having low testosterone, high cortisol, and other endocrine dysfunction, because that endocrine dysfunction will actually cause the psychiatric stuff.
Okay. Well, that's so good.
From a nursing perspective, from how I'm trained, like I said, when I look at syndromes, I'm looking at sort of what the patient is telling me. So I'm trying to mitigate, I'm trying to help strategize with them how to deal with the symptoms. But I have found that not a lot of folks in psych know to do the blood work and do the other testing before they diagnose operators. That's what we're seeing.
Okay, that's good. That's a good protocol that I guess is probably going to be more standard.
I hope so. Yeah, that's what we're trying to do. That's why people have to publish on it, like Dr. Free, other people out there, myself included. We need to talk about this so that people who work with operators know.
Yeah.
That's
really good. So tell me this, with your doctoral research, how did the focus of trauma symptoms and chronic pain, what did you learn with that?
So what I learned actually from the SEALs who were talking to me on background is they were telling me that so much of their chronic pain was caused by a traumatic incident. They could point to something, like there was a Humvee rollover. And when I talk about trauma, and also in this context of trauma symptoms, I'm not talking necessarily about like what that stereotypical PTSD stuff. I'm talking about memories of a traumatic experience, like a Humvee rollover, where everyone survived, but this guy I'm talking to hurt his back, or there was a fast roping accident, something happened during deployment that was very upsetting. And a lot of times guys can point at this thing that happened that was traumatic, that was the cause of their pain perhaps. And what happens is when they remember that incident or something brings it up, they have pain. And we see this, I mean, it happens to everybody. I think probably anyone who has chronic pain from an actual event.
And when you say event, you're talking a physical, painful event, right? But it can also be an emotional, traumatic event.
Yes.
As well.
It could be both.
Got it.
Both or either.
Right. Okay. Good.
And so what these guys, like I said, were telling me is that, this horrible thing happened or this traumatic thing happened. And now I have this pain in this specific part of my body. And for some of them, if you were to look at that part of their body on imaging, maybe they've had surgeries to it, maybe it's fixed, maybe it's not, but you could look at that part of their body and say, yeah, obviously you're having pain. But for a lot of them, and for a lot of members of the general population, if you look at that part of that body on imaging, or it's assessed by a provider, a physician or a nurse practitioner or PA or whomever, there's nothing wrong with that part of their body anymore. It has healed if there was ever anything to heal, but they continue to have pain. And researchers over decades have found that that is a real link.
Okay.
And so what I did in my research is endeavor to find, to use that link to treat the link. Because if you break the link, you can also break apart that the memory and the pain response to a certain extent. And that's what I did. I treated the link between.
That's really interesting. So you're saying is that I have this traumatic injury to my leg, and that series of bone, joint, muscle, tendons, ligaments, you know, all of that has a memory that is an emotional memory tied to it.
Yes.
Wow. How does that happen?
So it's super interesting. So I always talk about the brain just being like, I'm not going to use the words, but
I'm sorry to interrupt because I know this is going to get good, but the way I've always, the brain's job is there for us to survive as a species, right? It is there to tell us, why are you doing this? Stop doing this. Remember what happened to you the last time you did this?
Yes.
You know, those type of things. And, you know, it's also there, you know, whenever you're going through very challenging times of like making you ask questions like, why are you doing this to yourself? Right. It wants you to survive. It thinks you're going to die.
Yes.
So, yeah. How does that happen? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
totally fine. I always tell people like your brain's a jerk, right? Like your brain operates by itself. It doesn't care about you. It just wants to survive, just basically like you just said. So what happens is, this is like a super interesting thing. So no one, hopefully, is born with chronic pain, right? Usually chronic pain is something that develops for most people, okay? Sure. Chronic pain develops at a certain point. So does trauma. Trauma develops at a certain point. And generally speaking, we only have X number of pathways in our brain. So what will happen is when new stuff happens, and this is all out there, there's models, there's people way smarter than me that are talking about this, that have basically proven this. Your brain has to do something with chronic pain, and it has to do something with trauma. So it sort of assigns those things to pathways in your brain. And what has happened is the reason that we know that this happens is because over time, researchers have found that if you treat chronic pain, you tend to treat trauma. If you treat trauma, you tend to treat chronic pain. And the idea is that because your brain has to put its trauma pathways and its chronic pain pathways, either the brain is using the same pathway or the pathways are next to each other. So if you're treating this one, because they're next to each other, you're also treating this one. If this pathway improves, this pathway improves. This is your trauma. This is your chronic pain. And we know this is accurate because we can do this both with medication and with therapy.
Oh.
And so medication changes the chemistry in your brain. So if we give somebody, for example, a medication that helps with trauma, chronic pain scores improve, in addition to the trauma scores. Okay. If we use therapy to talk to people about their chronic pain or their trauma, what therapy is actually doing is rewiring some of the stuff that's going on in your brain, and your trauma and your chronic pain improve. We don't know if they're like this. We don't know if they're like this. Doesn't matter. Treating one treats the other. And so that is basically what happens in your brain. So when I mentioned earlier that my whole goal was to treat the glue that binds them, the thing that binds them, what I'm really doing is treating this part, this pathway in the brain. I provided former SEALs with something that is evidence-based that we know works to treat both. And I provided it to them and it worked.
Nice. So if you would, think about the person that comes to you first of just a really good story, right? Of what you did worked. These are very emotional things that occur when you're in that kind of profession, but I'm just curious, you know, how'd you do it? What'd you do? You know, what's the difference?
Yeah. So something I did on purpose, I knew based on research and based on what SEALs were telling me, is that if I treated the chronic pain, I would be treating the trauma. I knew that. I shared that information with the guys I was working with, but I didn't tell them to apply the chronic pain treatment to their trauma symptoms. I didn't tell them to do that. I just said, treating the chronic pain will improve your trauma. That's all I said. And I, having met the SEAL community for so many years, meeting guys where they are and talking with them and learning about the training that SEALs go through, learning how to be innovative, learning to be innovative, learning to apply things, I just figured that, I guessed that they would figure out that they should apply their chronic pain treatment to their trauma symptoms when they came up. I knew it. But I didn't, if I presented that information to other people, other researchers, other whatever, they'd be like, no, like who, no, you can't just assume that. But I knew that they would, and they did. And my very first, like, I get chills thinking about my very first SEAL that I debriefed after the research period was over. He said to me, he's like, Rebecca, I didn't tell you about some of my trauma. I didn't tell you during our onboarding meeting because I was afraid to share some of the stuff that was going on with me. But when I read about your research saying that, you know, the chronic pain, the treatment would treat my trauma, I thought this would be really good for me. So about 2 weeks into the research period, when they had access to all the information, he said, one night I woke up from nightmares and I said to myself, I should try what I'm trying for my chronic pain. And he was able to go back to sleep. And like, it brings tears to my eyes,
yeah.
You know, because what truly ended up happening is almost all of the guys told me about how much they were suffering with their trauma symptoms during the offboarding meetings. And it was way more than they had even shared with me at the onboarding meetings. And these guys were very vulnerable with me. I mean, the guys who signed up, who I accepted into my research, were guys who really were willing to be vulnerable. But there's like that next level of trust.
Sure.
And they didn't know me well enough to be willing to fully tell me everything. And I would say most of the guys decided just to apply things themselves on their own, just like I assume they would, based on their training.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
And because of that, what was the end result? Like, you know, at the end of your research, what did you learn because of their, you know, self, you know, healing ideas? What did you learn as part of that research?
One of the things I would really like to do is do the research again and tell them to apply it. That's the next step.
I gotcha.
Because I think that, so of course I did all of my research during the height of COVID. So I had a smaller sample size than I would have liked. You know, there were lots of complications because of COVID. So what I would really like to do is get another group of guys and do the same thing and tell them purposely to apply it. Because the guys who purposely applied it had a huge change in their trauma scores. All of them had a big change. But the guys who purposely applied it and told me they were purposely applying it had a pretty significant change.
Gotcha. So what is the procedures that they use to, what did they, when you say they applied it to this and they applied it to that, what does that mean?
So I basically provided them access to, I provided them access to what we call psychoeducation.
Okay.
In psych. And what it is literal education about how to reframe your thoughts.
Okay. Perfect.
Related to your chronic pain.
Okay.
And I think a lot of, generally, it seemed like a lot of the guys that I talked to, both in the background period and also the guys I accepted into the study, had like heard of that. Maybe they'd read about it, but they hadn't really had the opportunity to do it.
Okay.
And they weren't really given the information. Even the guys who were seeing the psychiatrists that are with the teams, you know, a lot of guys are required to go see a psychiatrist once a month with some regularity as part of being a SEAL nowadays. They hadn't necessarily received all the tools that they wanted to actually know how to reframe their thoughts and think about their chronic pain in a different way. And so what I did is I gave it to them. And so as they were learning these different skills about how to train their minds to think differently, they decided that they were going to use the same skills to try to train their mind to think about their trauma differently.
What's a better way to ask this question? Because I know you're in the middle of processing your research. So I don't want to go too deep into it. Operator syndrome and allostatic load, right? Mm-hmm. You had that term in there, and I wrote about it too in this article. I'm trying to get some good, you know, commonalities of the two. What have you found with those two terms that kind of helped guide your research?
So I actually just gave a presentation for one of the pipeline programs about managing allostatic load in terms of, hey, I don't ever want you to become my patient. I don't want you to develop severe operator syndrome. So let's talk about your allostatic load. Let's talk about how to mitigate the effects of allostatic load. And I will share that one of the tools that I gave to my group during my research study was mindfulness practices. And this is out there in the research.
Oh, sure. Yep.
5 minutes a day of mindfulness. 5 minutes. It could be any kind of mindfulness, but intentional mindfulness has now been shown to prevent and mitigate the effects of endocrine dysfunction.
Oh, nice.
That comes with allostatic load.
Okay.
And that's not my finding. I'm very happy to talk about it.
Okay.
That I found it in the research as I was developing this presentation for, it was for someone, you know, Jeff Nichols.
Yeah.
So I was doing an allostatic load presentation. And of course they do a lot of mindfulness there, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to tie in their mindfulness with this presentation. And so I did a literature review of what's already out there, what research is out there that associates mindfulness with allostatic load. And researchers have found that 5 minutes a day will actually decrease the severity of changes, of endocrine changes that occur with high allostatic load.
And now, do they think that is the initial cause down this road that the operator has that evolves into operator syndrome, that it starts off hormonally?
So I mentioned before that a lot of really interesting research has come out since 2020. So something a lot of folks are talking about that Dr. Free talked about initially was that probably the initiating factor for most operators is that repeated low level sort of TBI, the
sure, like just shooting a weapon.
Yes. Yeah. Breaching. Yeah. I just actually last night read an article that
breaching's
was,
big though. That's well, yeah, a big boom. Big.
But yeah, research done with Canadian armed forces for people who worked at the ranges, both as instructors and just people who worked there. For repeated TBI, that low-level concussive experience, and how it affected their brain function.
Interesting.
And what has been found, both in that research and other research that's come out more recently, is that that repeated low-level trauma to the brain is really affecting different functional axes in the brain, right? So now we're going back to neuroscience, but what it's doing is literally disrupting how your brain works over time.
Wow.
In these very small incremental ways. And because it's disrupting your brain function, it is therefore disrupting your endocrine function and your endocrine system.
Okay.
And with that endocrine system, you see the spiral.
Sure.
What happens over time is when you get that endocrine dysfunction, people start developing diabetes, pre-diabetes. They start developing pseudo-depression. They become suicidal. They have stress reactivity. And with all that endocrine stuff, they can't recover. They can't adequately recover. They can't sleep. They experience weight changes, fat storage changes. Oh my gosh. So many of the guys that I have talked to, like I said, I've talked to like at least about 100 Navy SEALs over the last 4.5 years at this point. So many of them who have separated from service before they're 20 did it because they couldn't keep up anymore with the younger guys on their team. And they were saying, yeah, you know, I started gaining weight. I just never felt ready for the next day. I never felt ready for deployment. You know, I just couldn't keep up. Oh my gosh. And I'm reading all of these studies about how over time, these repeated small traumas are causing these huge endocrine problems that cause weight gain, poor recovery, poor performance, poor readiness, lack of readiness. And I'm just, my mind is I'm seeing these connections from what I'm seeing in real life with the SEAL community and with what's in the research.
Yeah. So you're seeing it not necessarily from a massive TBI explosion, but from these micro traumas that are just small concussive blasts from moderate size caliber weapons that are causing it. Wow.
I'm actually, so I just opened, so what I'm trained to do as a doctor of nursing practice is to sort of collect all of the research. And I actually just opened up one of my research documents and I'm looking at a research document and it is talking about the effects of blasts over time and how it just disrupts everything. It destroys the brain slowly over time. So all of these symptoms of operator syndrome, what we see in practice is the end result of the things that are happening internally over a long period of time.
Right. Is there any, are there any recommendations yet to how many rounds should be shot in a day?
No. And so people are talking about that. People who do the research are talking about that, but they are not there yet.
Yeah.
And I think that that is kind of where things should be going. Hopefully coming up. So there are obviously conclusions being drawn as far as changing some of the training to perhaps move guys even further away from the blasts when they're training to do breaching. You know, can we somehow decrease maybe the number of rounds that they're firing, you know, quality over quantity? Do we need to be doing this all the time? You know, there's all of those discussions, but there's no finite number at this point that's been published.
Oh, okay. I'm going to change questions on you here, because there's something that has been very useful for my life. Yeah. And it's a term that I learned, I don't know, probably a decade and a half ago, called name it and tame it. Are you familiar with this?
No.
So it's more of a sports psychology thing, but you can apply it like you do to whatever, right? And in fact, I have applied it to dreams, right? I wake up and I have a bad dream, you know, instead of me sitting there thinking about it constantly, you know, I give it a different outcome. Mm-hmm. Right. So, and yes. I give it a name. Mm-hmm. Right. And I say, I'm going to name this. Well, that was stupid. You know, whatever. I just give it a silly name to it. And what I have found that helps with is, you know, instead of that being an obtrusive thought in my head for, you know, the rest of the night, it actually finds that little file in your brain and says, okay, we got a name for that. That's where that belongs. Right. So a lot of times these obtrusive thoughts, you know, often just need a name. Right. And if you give it a name, it finds its little location. And you have to do that, you know, as like a practice, because sometimes obtrusive thoughts still keep coming in regardless. You still got that. Nope. That belongs in that file. That belongs, you know, you got to keep putting it in that file. And eventually, like you mentioned, you've actually trained your brain to classify that for you without keeping you awake, without raising your cortisol levels, without, you know, so it takes care of that before it all of those symptoms happen. And it was a sports psychologist that taught us this a while back ago, and it was just simply called name it and tame it.
I love right? that.
So yeah. Any obtrusive thought, give it a name, put it in there. So I'm not sure if that actually has an application, that's just a nickname that he gives, you know, non-doctor types. They're like, just do this. You know, just shut up. Just go do this. You know, I don't know if that's similar to some of the suggesting treatments that you have, like I said, the psychiatric treatments that you have used.
Yeah. So that is amazing. And I'm going to write that down. And
yeah, it's a thing. You can Google it. I've written about it too. I've written about name it and tame it as well. So it's
perfect. Yeah. Is it on your blog? Cause I'm going to go look.
Yeah. For it. Yeah. You find it on military.com.
Awesome. Yeah. So there are a number of things that are really great practices. And a lot of it is about creating those habits, just like you just mentioned. That is thought reframing, creating a different habit of how you think about things. And that's powerful.
Yeah.
Because if you find like habitual ways to decrease your stress over time, it makes a huge impact. Even like small things. So I talk about cueing, and that's something that I do. It's a mindfulness practice. And what it is you associate calming your body down with something that you do, something that you think, something that you listen to. And like a lot of special operators, one thing I have in common with them is that I have really significant ADHD. My brain goes a million miles a minute. And not every operator has ADHD, but I hear about this from a lot of guys. That's like, your mind is going, it's very hard to focus. You have all of this stuff going on in your mind. So I have personally have a really hard time with mindfulness and with thought reframing. And I think that's part of why I'm so interested in it, because I struggle with it, right?
Sure.
So I do something called cueing, which is basically I have associated calming down, like intentionally calming down, lowering my heart rate, decreasing my breath rate, all of those things, with either thinking, well, listening to something, listening to a specific calming music, or repeating a Buddhist prayer that has a lot of meaning to me. So that in the moment, if I have a minute where I'm starting to get spun up, I cue. And I can now, at this point, think about the music or even just repeat the first line of the prayer, and my body is used to calming down and it reframes my thoughts. And that is the kind of intentional mindfulness that will help people over time mitigate some of this stuff that goes on with allostatic load. It's like small things during the day just that decrease your stress.
Okay, interesting. Another fairly recent, I don't even know if it's a study or not, or if it's just a practice that somebody's like, try this, right? Whether it's insomnia or maybe taking you from a sympathetic state to a parasympathetic state.
Yes.
Right.
That's cool.
Right. Yeah. Whether you are, you know, doing it through breathing, right? Relaxing, going to your happy place. Yeah. Or have you seen the one recently where they put cool pack or an ice pack on your chest? What is that doing? Is that actually like freezing my vagus nerve that makes me calm down? What is happening?
When you cool off, your body cools off, and so is your mind.
Okay. All right.
It calms you down. And I actually have never done any kind of research on it myself, looking through research others have done. But yes, that is absolutely a practice. And we do it in nursing. I mean, if you think about it, so if you're really familiar with like intensive care unit treatments and different things, we literally cool people off.
Okay.
We will literally, to preserve brain function and physical function, we cool people off.
Okay, that makes sense.
So I think that there's absolutely evidence for it there. And I've heard of it. And I can imagine it being really a good trigger.
Yeah. I read an article. In fact, it was on Psychology Today, their website, and looks like it was written maybe a few months ago. But it's called, Can Icing Your Chest Help You Fall Asleep? So they're applying it more to the insomnia side, which is very similar to what's going on. You're a sympathetic, can't fall asleep. You got to get into that rest digest phase. Into the parasympathetic side. But yeah, it's pretty interesting. This doctor, PhD type, is talking about this, and it's really interesting. So
I'll look that up.
Yeah, check that out as well. Because my wife tried it the other day, and she goes, and she was like, this is a bunch of hocus pocus, because she saw it on TikTok, right?
Okay.
So she's like, let me try it. And so she tried it. And then I'm watching her, because we're just sitting in the living room, and I'm watching her do it. And all of a sudden I see her do this. Right. Took that big, deep exhale, you know, where she's kind of slowly changing her states. And I was like, she goes, you know what? This may be working. So just wanted to ask you that one.
That's so interesting. I'm going to look that up and try it myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah. So, you know, there's definitely something to, you know, helping people, you know, it doesn't even matter whether it's, you know, special ops guys or it's, you know, people that are just stressed out, period, you know, hormonally speaking, it's all the same, you know. you got bullets flying over your head over here, yeah. but you can't pay your bills over here. Guess right. what? It's the same stress hormone flowing through your body and you're stressed. So, yep. You know, I think this has amazing applications for everybody. Yeah. And I think the quicker, you know, people realize there are nice little natural tools that can help us with that jerk part of our brain, like you mm-hmm. mentioned earlier, that's really meant for us to just survive and live another day without hurting ourselves and creating more trauma, you know, the better we will be, you know.
While we're talking about treatments, I wanted to mention two things that have come up in recent studies that have really good applications with operator syndrome.
Okay.
So we mentioned Dr. Free's work earlier with the low testosterone.
Yes.
Around the same time in 2020, there was an article that came out that actually specifically talked about low testosterone in special operations forces and supplementation of exogenous testosterone.
Okay.
And there's some really good information. So one of the things for anyone listening is with operator syndrome, one of the very first things that we see is a significant decrease in testosterone to a point where you have SEALs who are active duty whose testosterone is lower than mine as a woman.
Yeah, I've seen those studies. And yeah. You know, it's like 29-year-old guys that are, you know, got the testosterone of a, you know, 70-year-old.
An elderly lady.
Yeah.
Truly. Yeah. So one of the interesting things with low testosterone that have been found are things like, obviously it affects your sleep. So guys who have low testosterone average 3 hours of sleep per night. Oof. I can't imagine operating and having that little sleep. And yeah. if that's the general average, that means that there are people who are sleeping less. So there has been some calls to actually fully supplement with testosterone. So if anyone is listening who thinks that they might have operator syndrome, the very first thing to do is to go to their primary care and request a hormonal level check. Yeah. And not just for the testosterone, but for everything else to see how things are leveling out with each other. And there's really good evidence for actually supplementing. And I haven't seen any information about how much to use, but that might very well be something to talk about with your primary care.
Sure.
To just start supplementing and see how it goes. And what we can see is it will help with your lean body mass, which is a huge thing with operator syndrome over time, because a lot of guys will start gaining weight.
Sure.
And also it could potentially preserve some of the strength and just general readiness, reaction time, things like that when you're in a high stress environment, and it's going to promote your recovery.
Right.
So that's the very first thing to do. The other thing that I thought was really interesting, this came out in 2021, specifically supplementing special operations forces with fish oil. Oh. And I know that that has been a thing for a long time. A lot of guys take fish oil.
Sure.
But very quickly, some of the research that has come out specifically with special operators is that supplementing actively with high quality fish oil may prevent TBIs, mild TBIs, and it will mitigate the symptoms of TBIs, which includes all of that cognitive stuff, that cognitive clouding, the memory loss, the mental fatigue. Also, we see with repeated low-grade TBI, sort of like concussive waves and things, that we see some issues with special operators and other people performing both physical and mental work at the same time. We actually see a decrease in their ability and their in the rate, how fast they can actually perform those things together over time. So the discussion is that perhaps they should be supplementing with fish oil as a routine thing, all special operators.
Okay.
And the
more as a preventative, even
as a preventative, it should start early.
Okay.
Because if you think about it, if you get guys before they go to buds, how often are they at the firing range when there are buds? How often are they doing, are they around blasts? How often, and you know, and you think about it and you're like, oh, it's not really that much. But if you start early and you get this stuff in your system and it becomes a habit and your body has it in its system, if it has any positive effect, that's huge.
Sure. And
guys, I mean, you know, buds, SQT, you can have head injuries there.
Sure. Yeah.
So starting it early.
Interesting.
Yep.
And those are two studies that you have found in your research.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's really cool. Nice. Yeah.
Yep. And they're both of them are actually in the Journal of Special Operations Medicine.
Okay. Sweet.
Yeah. So, I mean, these are SOCOM associated research.
Yeah.
Specifically with special operators.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's really good. So, you know, let's kind of wrap this up a little bit, Rebecca. What's next for you? What is next in your journey? First of all, I want to say thank you for going down this path because it is very well needed. And, you know, thanks for working with, you know, many of people that I know that, you know, need somebody that understands this a little bit better. And, you know, like you just were able to do, you gave them a set of tools that is going to help them for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. So what is next for you and how do you plan on taking this to the next level?
So I actually just started a website called tacticalpsychiatry.com.
Oh,
and cool. Yeah. And I'm in the process of, I guess incorporating, you would say,
sure,
an LLC. And the reason I'm doing this is because I want to continue working with the SEAL community and special operations community generally. And I would like to do it for free.
Oh.
So cool. I'm trying to figure out how to do that, how to provide supportive psych services to active duty and former SEALs for free. But also what I do on that website is I actually post a lot of the journal articles so that people can read stuff for themselves.
Okay, good.
I think it's really important because part of my mission is I want to get this information to people who need it. And I think it should be as free as possible and as accessible as possible to people who are so that they can actually see the information, see the research for themselves and draw their own conclusions. I think that's
100%. Really, yeah.
So, and also resources like some of your resources and your podcast and things like that. So you can go there and I actually have a reading tab and you can start to look through a lot of the articles that I have talked about today. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that it looks like I'll be going to the SEAL reunion, the UDT SEAL reunion on the West Coast, hopefully.
Okay, cool.
And cool. Providing information about operator syndrome for free.
Nice.
To anyone who's interested in it, as well as some of the things that we talked about today, just information about testosterone and fish oil and anything that I can find that is out there in the research. But I really want to continue doing this work. There are not very many people who, it's not just operator syndrome, it is Navy focused operator syndrome. There's not a lot of us who do it. I've met a couple people who work with Army Special Forces. And so far, Dr. Free and I are like, you know, kind of the only people I found who are civilians,
right,
who work on operator syndrome with SEALs.
Okay.
And I will say that part of the reason I want to do this is because I can't work with my husband's community. And I wish there was someone who did this with his community with tactical aviation. They don't have operator syndrome, but they have other stuff.
Oh, sure. Yeah. They have other stresses that come with that job too. So tell me this, and this would be my last question for you.
Yeah.
Your husband's a fighter pilot.
Yes.
What did he think of the Top Gun sequel?
Oh my gosh, we loved it. So he's been deployed since January. So I just saw him for the first time like last week.
Nice.
Very exciting. At a port call, and we were able to go watch it together. And we actually with a whole bunch of guys from a squadron, and everyone loved it.
Nice. Loved I love it. I tell you what, you know, that original, you know, back in the 80s was my big thing that turned my head towards the Navy. You know, and I went to the Naval Academy and, you know, wanted to be a fighter pilot. And I also wanted to play football, and I wound up doing neither. So I played rugby and went to butts. So, but you know, I had plans that got me into that journey, and things change, but I wouldn't change them back, but always enjoy my pilot friends and, and their job and the things that they do. Cause it's really amazing, some of the things that they do, but yeah, I agree with you. I love the movie myself.
Yeah. My husband supported a lot of SEAL missions when he was flying over Afghanistan. So yeah, he loves working with you guys.
That's cool. Yeah. Cool. Good stuff. Well, hey, thank you very much, Rebecca. Do we call you doctor yet? Dr. Rebecca?
Yeah, I'm officially a doctor.
Okay. So we'll say Dr. Ivory. Great job.
Thank you.
And tacticalpsychiatry.com.
Yep.
Okay.
There's a reading tab. I'm not sharing it to try to make money. Believe me,
right.
I want people to have the opportunity to read some of these studies, and I already have a lot of them posted, and I'll make sure some of the newer ones are up there too.
Well, that is the key to all of this is education. Mm-hmm. And I found it the same thing on a pre buds level with fitness. It's really an education, mm-hmm. you know, because there are things that typical athletes don't understand about Spec Ops Fitness, mm-hmm. right? Just like there's a lot of things that, you know, SEALs don't understand about, you know, psychology and psychiatry, right? And, you know, with a few tools and some references to bounce, you know, and learn a little bit from, that's a very healthy way to just, you know, I always say we have this backpack of tools, you know, in our you know, that we carry around with life, you know, and that backpack should be getting heavier every year. And, you know, this is just another set of tools that we can use to, you know, get through whatever challenges that you're having post service or different, you know, stresses that come up with life, you know, in mm-hmm. general. So I really appreciate one, your journey, but also two, sharing it with me. And, you know, I'm able to share it with other folks that are interested in this profession too. So I know it will be helpful, not only between you and me discussing it, but also other people discussing this and seeing this and just realizing there are a set of tools out there that can help them with those challenges.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I love spreading information about this and helping people help themselves. So thank you very much. And for everything you do for the community too.
Oh, absolutely. And all right. So one more time, Dr. Ivory, thank you so much for your time. And everybody go check out Tactical Psychiatry if you want to learn some more, but also go online, Google Operator Syndrome. Please. It's a thing. You know, I even follow Operator Syndrome hashtag on Instagram. Yep. And there's some really cool stuff on there too. Some active SEALs are giving testimonials every day on, you know, just discussing what that is and how they're coping with it. So, mm-hmm. yeah, absolutely. So thank you again. This has been very, very helpful.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. Until next time, we'll see you later.